You're listening to Women's Magazine on KPFA 94.1 FM. I'm Kate Raphael. We've all heard a lot in recent months about the abuse of boys by priests, but there have been many other cases we haven't heard nearly so much about, cases where the people being abused are women and girls. And while we know a lot about the cover-up by the men at the top of the church hierarchy, we don't know much about what women are doing to bring these abuses to light and end them. Joining me now by phone, I'm excited to have Angela Bonavolia. Angela is the author of Good Catholic Girls, How Women Are Leading the Fight to Change the Church. She's also an award-winning journalist on reproductive health issues and a frequent contributor to the Huffington Post, Ms., and the Women's Media Center blog. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, Mirabella, Cosmopolitan, The Nation, the Chicago Tribune, and the National Catholic Reporter, among others. So the first thing that occurred to me when I started hearing about the latest abuse scandal was that we only seem to hear about the abuse of boys. And it just doesn't seem likely that girls and women are not also being abused. And then I found an article by you and some others which document widespread abuse of women in the church. Why do you think we hear so little about this?
There are a number of reasons for that. I think one is that the church has focused on the abuse of boys and not the abuse of girls. And there are thinkers in the church who believe that partly because historically the church has seen the abuse of girls, particularly teenage girls, as kind of a variant of normal sexuality. And this is the thinking of Richard Sipe, who is a former Benedictine monk and a very astute observer of the sex abuse scandals. In fact, in one of the articles that came out recently in the New York Times about the current cases of sex abuse around the world that people are paying attention to, in one of them, the authorities decided that the thing to do with this priest who was accused of abusing boys was to move him to a school, a girls' school, where somehow they assumed things he would, you know, not be a problem. Just to give you an example, even of the more current attitudes of the church fathers to women victims, there was a woman by the name of Nancy Sloan who was just this side of puberty when she was molested by a Father Oliver O'Grady. And she told me, you know, he left her with the memory of severe pain while he was trying to penetrate an 11-year-old. Well, she told her parents told the pastor, and this was up in Northern California. The pastor advised O'Grady to write a letter of apology to her parents, and he did. And in the letter, he actually admitted to touching Nancy in areas I shouldn't have and that he went a little too far. And all I could think when I read that was how astonishing that was as a disclaimer, because how far is not too far for a grown man to go with an 11-year-old girl? And O'Grady, actually, he was the subject of a riveting documentary that was done a couple of years ago, and it was all about him, and it focused on another female victim of his. The film was called Deliver Us from Evil, and it was by Amy Berg.
How much do you think homophobia has to do with it?
I mean, this is a homophobic church, and it's really complicated, the whole level of that. But I don't think the problem is heterosexuality or homosexuality. I think the problem is duplicity. I think this is a church that has insisted and put itself forth in the world as having a celibate priesthood. It has also made the claim that celibacy is sexually superior to any other state. And so when that has failed, when the reality has not been that, the church has gone to all ends to hide it. And that's really what I think happened. And what's really interesting, I was listening last week to Leveda, Cardinal Leveda, who's now the head of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, who was on the NewsHour. And he was talking about the reasons for the sex abuse crisis. And one of the things he said, which really floored me, was he said, and I'll quote, "I think the causes we will see go back to changes in society that the church and priests were not prepared for, particularly changes involving how to be a celibate person in the time of a sexual revolution." Richard Sipe has done research, and it's not current, it's a few years old, but I mean, he has found that many priests are sexually active, the fewest of them with very small children. When the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, when they appointed their commission to look at this problem, they found and admitted that it was the greater problem was priest involvement with adults and with vulnerable adults.
One of the things I learned really very recently, and I learned it from Ken Follett, as a matter of fact, was that initially the priesthood wasn't celibate and that that was a somewhat recent phenomenon.
Right. It wasn't until like the 13th or 14th century that celibacy was imposed. And at that point, they kind of threw the wives out of the houses. I mean, they basically abandoned them. And most people feel it was because of inheritance issues, that it was, you know, you had all these children who were inheriting, you know, potentially going to be inheriting church property. That was not such a great thing to the church. But in the meantime, they have become so invested in this, and it's completely illogical because they have opened the door to married men who come from other denominations where marriage is allowed. They can't be bishops who are married, but they can be priests who are married. But if their wife dies, and I think this is kind of macabre, they can't remarry.
I don't want to dwell too much on the gory details, but one of the scandals or one of the cases that I was really shocked to learn about that I had heard nothing about until I started researching for this piece was something that broke in, I think, 2001, involving the rape of nuns in 23 countries, mostly in Africa, I think. Can you talk about that?
Yes, that was just such an incredible report, and it kind of illustrates what I'm talking about here in terms of what the real problem is. That was back in 2001, and it was actually the National Catholic Reporter that broke the story. They analyzed internal church reports to Catholic nuns. These were not any external people. These were not outside media trying to capitalize on something which the church keeps accusing the media of. This was two nuns, and one was a physician, a medical missionary of Mary, and the other was the AIDS coordinator for the Catholic Funds for Overseas Development. And they documented, as you said, the sexual exploitation of nuns by priests in 23 countries on 5 continents, but as you say, most are in Africa. And the allegations were incredible. The most stunning one was a nun impregnated by a priest who forced her to have an abortion. She died from complications, and he then officiated at her funeral. There were priests alleged to have raped young nuns who wanted certificates to enter religious orders, told the nuns that oral contraceptives would protect them from AIDS, and used the nuns as safe alternatives to prostitutes. Even some priests went so far as to demand that heads of conference make the nuns sexually available to them. Now, the Vatican at that time, when there was a call to action campaign was conducted around this report, and that was conducted by a great organization called Catholics for Free Choice, as well as some other organizations. It was an international coalition. The call to accountability about this sexual abuse of nuns and other women by Catholic priests. And the Vatican, when they learned about it, they wrote back that the problem was known, but it was restricted to a geographically limited area. And they said that they would be focusing on seminary training and the solution of single cases.
Turning now to some of the more inspiring stories rather than the more depressing stories. Good
yes.
Catholic Girls is the result of interviews with almost 200 women who are challenging and changing the church. I'm sure that it must be hard to choose, but can you tell us a few of the stories?
Oh, God, the women were just fantastic. You know, and I grew up Catholic myself, Kate, so I have a very checkered history with the church of leaving and, you know, kind of, but it's very hard to leave the Catholic Church. It's kind of like being Italian, and I'm Italian. You know, it's very hard to just abandon it. And it really was when I learned about a nun named Sister Joan Chittister back in 2001 that I really perked up. She had been invited to speak at the first World Conference on Women's Ordination in Ireland. And when the Vatican got word of it, they contacted the prioress at her monastery and said, basically, she can't go. And the prioress had to really sit with that and decide whether she was going to silence Sister Joan. And the bottom line was, Sister Joan went to Ireland, and the prioress did not silence her. And not only that, this is a Benedictine monastery up in Erie, Pennsylvania, and they had a meeting in the chapel, and there are the 100-and-some members of that community at the meeting, and that's when the prioress told them, I cannot be used as an instrument of silencing. I think we have more to lose by that. And then she said she was sending a letter to the Vatican, and she invited any of the women there who wanted to sign it to do so. And then all of these nuns came to the front of this chapel and signed this paper. And, you know, some of them are on walkers and wheelchairs. Some of them are quite old. One area that I think is crucial to recognize is that Catholic women have been leading advocates for the survivors of clergy sexual abuse. I'm sure your listeners have probably come across the name of Barbara Blaine. And had there been no Barbara Blaine, there would be no survivors network of those abused by priests. She spent almost a decade trying to get justice from the Archdiocese of Toledo for the sexual molestation she suffered from, like, eighth grade through high school at the hands of a local parish priest. And she not only worked on her own behalf, she had gathered a small group of victims of priest abuse back in 1989 at the Holiday Inn in Chicago, and their birth snapped. The organization snapped. Today, it's the largest and most powerful voice for clergy sex abuse survivors in the United States and probably worldwide. And people don't remember this, but, you know, the Boston scandal, when that broke, mm-hmm. It was a woman, Judge Constance Sweeney, a Catholic, and she broke with tradition and ordered the release of thousands of documents, secret documents, of alleged sex abuse by priests in Boston, and she based it on the public's right to know.
Do you think that the events of the last few months have created an opening for women to make some progress on these issues?
I do. I think that we're finally getting at a clearer picture of the factors that have made not only the sexual abuse issues, you know, not only the sexual abuse happen, but the factors that need to be changed to bring the church into the modern world. And crucial to that is eliminating compulsory celibacy, not optional celibacy. That's different. If someone chooses to live a celibate life, whether they're a religious person or not, that's a fine choice. But this is compulsory celibacy, and we have seen what the consequences, to my mind, are of compulsory celibacy. And we're also seeing, and there's a lot of conversation you'll see, and I'm sure your listeners have seen this on the blogs and on various talk shows, about what happens when there are no women in the room, when you've only got one half of the human race represented in discussions that affect the lives of men and women, and women, I would say, much more dramatically, because the church takes these very strong positions against things like birth control, contraception, condoms to prevent the spread of AIDS. So I think there's going to be more pressure now, and this will embolden the movements within the church to have women priests and women deacons and women on the altar and women in the rooms where all these decisions are made. And there is just this wonderful women's ordination movement that was started several years ago by really fantastic Catholic women, not women who, you know, just kind of walked in off the street. I mean, these are women who have worked in parishes for decades, who have masters in divinity, who are devoted Catholics, who have said, I feel called to be a priest. And while this pope has not excommunicated a single priest who abused a child or a single bishop who allowed that abuse to occur, he has stepped forward to excommunicate any woman who would dare to be ordained a Catholic priest who wants to serve the needs of spiritually hungry Catholics all over the world. When I was writing Good Catholic Girls, I came upon a book by Peter Steinfels, who mm-hmm. writes for the New York Times Religion, and he wrote a book called A People Adrift. And in it, he said, and I'll just quote this, over the long run, nothing in Catholic Christianity, like nothing in other forms of Christianity, or in Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, or even Hinduism, will remain untouched by the passage from a patriarch era to one of female equality. No one should be confident about predicting which elements of the great religions will be radically revised, which will be reconfigured, and which will remain relatively intact. And I think we are all on a journey, you know, and we can't even envision what's at the end of this. But it'll be better. I trust utterly in God our Mother that it will be better.
Well, that is a great way to end. My guest has been Angela Bonavolia. She's the author of Good Catholic Girls, How Women Are Leading the Fight to Change the Church. Angela, thank you so much.
To read Angela's work or buy her book, Good Catholic Girls, go to www.goodcatholicgirls.com. You'll also find links there to many other articles about the activism of Catholic women. And this is Women's Magazine on KPFA 94.1 FM and online at kpfa.org.